From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. So far, we've burned through half of the TARP funds. That's the $700 billion Trouble Asset Relief Program. Yesterday, President-elect Barack Obama requested that President George W. Bush ask Congress for the second half. That way, the new administration would have it available soon after the inauguration. So where did the first $350 billion go? Are we seeing any results? Here to help us understand the ins and outs of TARP is DeRoy Murdoch. He's a media fellow with the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University. Hi, DeRoy.
Hi, Frey. How are you?
I am doing quite well. Tell us about this $350 billion. The Bush administration mostly focused on buying stakes and ailing banks, and critics say that that shored up Wall Street, but not Main Street. Do you agree with that assessment, that critique, and what did happen with the money?
I agree with that critique completely. This was not, this money may have been sold as a way of helping homeowners in trouble, a way of bailing people out of foreclosures and this sort of thing. But primarily what this money did was go to big banks and medium-sized banks. A lot of this money went to, essentially was forced on big banks, including healthy banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America. And the theory was that if a weak or sick bank took money from the government, people might think, well, this bank's not in good shape, so I better pull out my money and take it elsewhere. And so the notion was, let's not stigmatize these sick banks. Let's give money to the big healthy banks so that they will the unhealthy banks will be able to blend in among them. This strikes me as a bit like saying, well, we don't want to stigmatize people on food stamps, so we're going to give food stamps to wealthy people so they also will buy their groceries with food stamps. This is an astonishing thing. This is the ultimate in corporate welfare. Big banks like J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Bank of America essentially were forced by the Fed, or very much had their arms twisted by the Fed and the Treasury, to take $25 billion. Some somewhat smaller banks had to take $20 billion. So a lot of this money was just an enormous sum given to these big institutions.
Me ask, why did they agree if they think they didn't need it?
Well, I think essentially, when you're dealing with Uncle Sam, you essentially are given an offer you can't refuse. You know, okay, well, you don't want to take this money if you don't want to, but good luck next time you want anything from us. And I think that they were essentially coerced into taking this money. I don't know if they didn't literally have guns put to their heads, but when you've got the head of the Fed or the head of the Treasury and you're running a major bank and they say, we want you to do this, I think at that point you just say, yes, sir, may I have another. Now, it would have been bad enough had they done this happened and then these banks turned around and started lending again. Many of them have taken this money and essentially hung on to it as a rainy day fund paid for by America's taxpayers. I think another important point that I hope people will remember is that we're not just talking about $350 billion that have been shelled out already, plus another $350 billion that President-elect Obama has requested when asked to by President Bush. The entire bailout is not $700 billion or $1 trillion. The amount of money that has been shelled out between mainly since Labor Day, but throughout 2008 up until now, in terms of actual outlays, loans, grants, this kind of thing, comes to $3.35 trillion. This is according to the Washington Post's research up through the day before Thanksgiving. It gets even worse. If you look at the guarantees, the so-called backstops, all the commitments the government has made, the amount of money, according to the Washington Post, is $8.15 trillion. Now, I shared those numbers with Pat Toomey, who's the head of the Club for Growth, a former Republican member of the House of Representatives, and he said, well, those are pretty grim numbers, but I think they forgot something. They forgot the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac nationalization. I contacted the Washington Post. They said, oops, you're right, we forgot to include that. Once you put that in, the commitment number becomes $3.35 trillion, and the outlay number is $3.35 trillion. The commitments, the guarantees, all that stuff, that then goes up to $13.35 trillion. So we're talking about $13 trillion here that basically has been spent without much supervision, without much accountability, without much transparency, mainly since Labor Day. This is an enormous step into nationalization and socialization, such as I never would have imagined place in this country, particularly under a so-called conservative Republican president.
I was going to raise that because yesterday when President Bush gave his last official press conference, he mentioned that he was getting criticized by some members of his party for some of the economic actions taken in the last days of his presidency. And he said, well, I hope that if they were faced with a situation like this, they would do something, you know, even if it wasn't in keeping with what their fiscal ideology said. We don't have very much time, but do you think it was a smart move for this president, our outgoing president, to push the structure of this kind of a bailout?
No, it's calamitous. I lately in my op-ed pieces have referred to him as Comrade Bush. I think that he has turned out to be like a giant Trojan horse who in his last days has turned this into a socialist republic, and I don't think I'm being hyperbolic. We have nationalized companies in this nation in the last couple of months. We've got the federal government owning major shares of financial institutions, an insurance company, car companies. This is the kind of stuff I would have expected maybe President Howard Dean would have done had he been hopped up on steroids. To have a conservative Republican who claims to be one of the heirs of Ronald Reagan do this is one of the most dramatic and spectacular acts of political apostasy this country has seen. And many of us who supported him and many of us who believe in free markets are appalled and apoplectic over this. And certainly he could have done things that were market-oriented, or if they had to be big government-oriented, could have been much less so. They've engaged in an enormous expansion of government. Nationalization is now part of the American political and economic vocabulary. I never thought I would see this in my lifetime. And again, to have a so-called conservative Republican do this to this country and to his base and his party, this is just an appalling and spectacularly negative development. And I don't think he can leave the office soon enough as a result.
Okay, DeRoy, no small words. Thank you.
Thank you, Farai. Good to talk to you.
That was DeRoy Murdoch, media fellow with the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University. He's also a syndicated columnist with the Scripps Howard News Service. And now we are going to turn to Congresswoman Maxine Waters. She sits on the House Financial Services Committee, which has jurisdiction over TARP. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Always great to talk to you. We just heard from DeRoy Murdoch, who gave an analysis as a conservative, as a libertarian conservative, that basically said the president is doing us wrong by moving ahead with a program like TARP. Party lines have been divided over this, within the Democratic and Republican parties. What's your perspective on the usefulness of TARP and how the money that has not been allocated is best used?
Well, let me kind of give you a little bit of the history of TARP. As you know, we were confronted with an emergency situation where the Secretary Paulson, came to us and said, we're in a crisis. Over the weekend, prior to his been in contact with us about our crisis, he had engineered a big sale on Wall Street because it appeared that if one of the big banks that was involved in the sale had gone bust up on that weekend prior to the markets opening on Monday morning, it would have triggered a depression. When he came to us as the treasurer, knowledgeable about the economy, describing the dire situation, he had a four-page proposal. It really did shake everybody up, but we tried to put some meat on the proposal and not just give him what he was asking for with no strings attached. What we basically said was, okay, the situation that you're describing is a crisis, and what we're going to do is we're going to go along with your request for a bailout. But we're not going to let you spend a $700 billion. We're going to give you half of that. We're going to give you some flexibility. And then you've got to come back and report what happened with that money. How did it work? We have to examine how did it affect the crisis, the economic crisis that you're describing. And then we'll decide whether or not to go forward with the additional $350 billion. Now, I want you to know, nobody knows exactly how to fix this problem. And so, yes, we did give him flexibility and had to trust that what he was saying and what he knew was as good as information as we could get. So we agreed that the epicenter or at the center of the crisis was the subprime meltdown that had created all of these foreclosures. that was what was causing the breakdown in this economy. We agreed at that time that the government would go in and buy up all of the toxic paper in these financial institutions so that we could modify them.
Congresswoman, we don't have very much time left, but
yes.
I do want to ask, what about accountability? What safeguards do you think should be put into the disbursement of the additional money, but also to what's already been given out, to make sure that it goes to do what you want it to do?
Well, obviously, based on what happened the first time, when the money didn't go for what we thought it was going to go for, we have to design in the bill that Barney Frank is going to put forth a lot of criteria for getting the money, for spending the money, reporting back, responsibility, all of that must be built in to the degree that we can do it.
When you think about what that would look like, give me one example, one small example of
how. First thing we have to say is something in the neighborhood of $40, $50 to $100 billion must be spent on foreclosures. And it must be done this way. We're going to use the FDIC Sheila Bair plan because she has shown, working with IndyMac, that she knows how to do loan modifications, and that has to be written into the bill. And then the other thing that you have to do is you have to develop criteria for who is going to get this money and why they're going to get it, what kind of reporting they have to do, and some prohibitions against being able to get the money if you don't do certain things. For example, we can't be giving bailouts to CEOs who have big stock options and bonuses, and all of that has got to be written into the TARP legislation.
All right. Well, Congresswoman, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Congresswoman Maxine Waters. She sits on the House Financial Services Committee and represents California's 35th District. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It is time now for Africa Update. This week, a South African appeals court rules the corruption case against African National Congress leader Jacob Zuma can move forward. Plus, shock at the jail term given to 9 Senegalese gay men. And Africans await Barack Obama's inauguration with mixed expectations. For more, we've got Amira Woods. She is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hey, Amira.
How you doing, Farai?
I'm doing great. So,
awesome.
Yesterday, a South African court cleared the way for corruption and racketeering charges to be filed against presidential hopeful Jacob Zuma. A lower court dismissed the case against the African National Congress leader on a technicality last September and claims that there was political interference by President Thabo Mbeki, led President Mbeki to step down. Now, where does this ruling, this new ruling, bring us, Amira?
Total chaos, Farai. Clearly, there's so much going on behind the scenes on this issue. Zuma's trial was on again, off again. Now it's on again. Will he be put forward on corruption charges, and what will be the political implications? Clearly, he is head of the largest political party, the African National Congress, the oldest party on the continent. But the ANC now is going through real pressures. The split between Mbeki, the ouster of Mbeki, the former president of South Africa, has now led to a split within the African National Congress. So this issue of Zuma and whether or not he's brought up on charges has led to real changes in the political landscape in South Africa. And as we move towards elections in the coming months, it could be April when there are presidential elections in South Africa, it is going to be interesting times to see, will this trial go forward? Will it be completed and there'll be a ruling before elections? And what would the implications of a possible ANC not led by Zuma mean for South African politics now and into the future?
As you know, we've talked about this new political party, COPE, and you've got the ANC, you've got COPE, you have questions over the economic direction of South Africa and whether or not it's inclusive enough, particularly in light of the 2010 World Cup, and whether or not there's going to be tension and protest by people who've been shut out of the economic growth. Do you see any real discussion that is forward thinking about how are you going to take people who have actually lost ground economically post-apartheid and lift them up?
That is the critical question. Many see that the trade union movement was the voice of the people for decades in South Africa. And yet with the economic strife that many are facing, remember there's a global economic crisis and South Africa is not left out of that situation. And you have real dire straits for people who had such high expectations, particularly after the end of apartheid, expectations that there will be housing, there will be jobs, you know. And these expectations have gone unmet for many people throughout South Africa, for the masses and the majority. So the key question is, as we see this new political party emerging really to the right of the African National Congress, this COP, the Congress of the People, to what extent will the pressures from the bottom up create new political forces in South Africa, potentially new parties to emerge on the left of the African National Congress? To what extent do all of these fissures really change the landscape so that you not only have political parties emerging, but a real challenge in terms of what will be the future direction of South Africa? Can there be an economy that works for people, for the miners, for the you know, farmers, for the those who are the majority, the workers of that country?
I want to move on to an issue of rights. At West Africa, there were 9 gay men in Senegal sentenced to 8 years in jail for, quote, indecent conduct and unnatural acts. According to the BBC, the men belong to a group helping to fight HIV and AIDS in the country. Senegal is predominantly Muslim. Homosexuality is illegal. Nonetheless, I think a lot of people were shocked by this ruling. What are we to make of it?
It is a travesty. It is absolutely a disaster when it comes to human rights to see this type of a ruling against really people who were fighting not only for the right to health, but really the right for dignity for all people. And it's not just Senegal. You see, you know, clearly Zimbabwe with Mugabe and his outbursts on homosexuality, but also you have comments coming very much from the president of Uganda. It is in a range of countries, really, where this type of homophobia has risen. But the good news, really, Farai, is that there are human rights activists across the continent that recognize that you cannot talk about social justice and leave out people who really have a right to express their sexual orientation. So this is a relatively new arena in the human rights agenda on the African continent and really around the world. But it's an agenda that we all must figure out ways to uphold so that we can arrive really at a 21st century world where all can live with dignity.
When you think about the trends on the continent that you see around gay and lesbian rights, is there anything we can point to? I mean, in South Africa, gays and lesbians can get married, which is more than you can say in most parts of the United States. But it's not is there a movement on the continent or?
Well, I do think there is the beginnings of a movement. Clearly, South Africa is one of the best. With the Constitution of 94, you had really enshrined in the Constitution rights for women, rights for people of all sexual orientation. You see such forward-looking advances in terms of social justice in that Constitution. And I think some of the other newer constitutions, Namibia, Mozambique, you know, this is, again, with a continent of, you know, 54 countries, if you count the Western Sahara, it is very rich in nuances. And I do think that you have some that are able to take the lead and create a sense of hope for others in the continent who also recognize the importance of this issue. So clearly, the South African human rights activists, but there are activists in Nigeria, in Uganda, in a number of countries around the continent that are creating a platform to raise these critical issues.
All right. Well, let's take a last stop on the politics train of Barack Obama. His Kenyan grandmother is on her way with a ceremonial spear for him. And someone said, you better bring that spear because he's going to need it the next 4 years. And
coming from Washington, I think that's absolutely right.
Exactly. For better, for worse, what are expectations that people from African nations, ones living in African nations or in the West, are bringing to this inauguration?
Well, I will start with the sense of joy, excitement, and pure shock that the president of the United States will be someone of African origin, someone who's not only lived, well, visited and spent time in Africa, but also lived in Indonesia and really is knowledgeable about the world. And I think there's a sense that it's not only a changed face in the White House, but an orientation that will help to change U.S. foreign policy and U.S. leadership in the world. I think there is, you know, there's also the I guess it's the foot on the ground, right? With all the celebration up in the air, the foot on the ground is basically saying, well, there are entrenched forces. There is an establishment that has built up a U.S. foreign policy and a U.S.-Africa engagement that has not worked for the interests of the African continent, that has created really an opportunity to militarize U.S. engagement in Africa with a newly established Africa Command, that has created an opportunity for exploitation of Africa's resources, especially its oil, but many other resources, and really that Africans in communities around the continent have paid the price. So I think there's a sense that there's high joy and expectation and excitement, but the realists really recognize that we have to temper the excitement and make sure that people both in the United States with an interest in a more positive foreign policy, a more positive U.S. engagement, not just in Africa, but in all the world, that it is time for those forces to stay vigilant, to organize, and to make sure that we create a space where Obama is not only held accountable, but is able to get some real changes put forward so that we can have not just a 4-year, but potentially an 8-year Obama term.
Amira, thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Farai.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she was at our New York studios. Now on to one woman's search for her African birth family. In 1974, Hannah Poole was adopted from an orphanage in Eritrea and raised in England by her adoptive white father. When she was 19, Hannah received a letter from a brother in Africa she never knew she had. That eventually led her to go to Eritrea to track down her surviving blood relatives. Hannah Poole chronicles that journey with humor in the book My Father's Daughter, A Story of Family and Belonging. She joins us now. Hannah, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you're a beauty journalist living in London, and your life is very cosmopolitan, very British. In some ways, you say that this experience made you feel even more British. But it took you 10 years to decide whether or not to really seek out your biological family. Take me to that process that you had of trying to make that decision.
Well, like you said in the introduction, when I was 19, as far as I knew, I didn't have any family. When my family in the UK adopted me from the orphanage in Eritrea, they were told I had no family. My father was dead, my mother was dead. I was, you know, quite literally an orphan. And so it was only when my father went back to Eritrea in 1993 for the independence celebrations that he visited the orphanage that they got me from. He left a photograph of me there with, there was actually the nun who was in charge of my adoption was still there. She's very sort of old now, but she was still there. And he left a photo of me because he thought it would be a nice thing to do. And several months after he returned, we got a letter from somebody who said he was my brother. And basically it turned out that after my father had left Eritrea, this nun had got in touch with my family. And that's when everything started to unravel.
When you got that letter and then started having phone calls, what did you consider? I guess I'll go back to a point where you talk about the risks of tracing your biological family, and you talk about times when people have been called ungrateful when they sought out their biological roots. Did you think this was dangerous to the integrity of the family that you'd grown up in?
Yeah, I'd lived in fear, really. Although I knew, well, I thought I knew I had no family, even the idea of going back to Eritrea made me feel somehow as if I was betraying the family that had adopted me. And so when I found out that actually, not only did I have family, we're not just talking, you know, aunties and uncles, it was my father was still alive, my birth father was still alive, and I had brothers and sisters. And so I felt like it was a huge betrayal, really. You have to understand, when you're adopted, there's sort of, I call it the elephant in the room that's there all the time between you and your adoptive family. No matter how much you love them, no matter how grateful you are for everything they've done for you, you still have this sort of, you know, urge often to trace your family. But you also know that that could be the hardest, the most damaging thing that you could do. It's almost like saying, thanks for looking after me, but actually I'd like to find the people who couldn't be bothered to even keep me.
Hmm. You went there and met your father. You have a very moving moment where you're literally standing in a doorway waiting to open it and to meet this man who you didn't know whether or not you would see because he'd been quite ill. What happened next?
Well, yeah, so I'd been in Eritrea for about 3 days, and then suddenly I was told that my father was here. He'd arrived a few days early. I'd expected to have quite a few days in Eritrea just to sort of get myself used to the place, because this was also my first time in Africa. So I was just expecting to have maybe a week in Eritrea, just getting myself reacclimatizing, really, I guess, to a place that I left when I was a baby. And I'd met with a cousin who was living in Europe, and he was the one that was acting as my guide and also as my translator, because there was a huge language problem as well, in that I didn't speak Tigrinya, which is the language that my family speak. So this man basically knocked on a door and sort of gently pushed me in. And inside, I knew my father was inside. I knew that my sister was there and that I had three brothers. What I didn't know was there were actually a whole load more family were waiting for me in the room. So it took a while. I mean, to be perfectly honest, when I walked into the room, I didn't know who was who. I could barely see. There was a huge rush when I walked into the room, and people came up to me and were sort of crying and hugging and kissing me. And so it was quite a long time before I really sort of came up for air, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you talk about being at a remove in some ways. With your typical humor in this book, you're like, I've felt more emotional watching an episode of EastEnders. Why do you think that was?
I think because after so much expectation, I think I'd probably played this scene in my head so many times, countless times, played it sort of where it had gone very, very badly, played it where I'd had fantasies where, you know, when I got to Eritrea, that my father had died before I'd got a chance to meet him. I'd had all these different scenarios. And then suddenly to actually just be there face to face with my father after 30 years was just such a hugely sort of intense emotional experience that almost all I could do was detach from it. And also, the other thing, you mentioned earlier on how I said in the book that I felt incredibly British when I went there. And actually, they were very, very emotional there. And I sort of almost wanted to just hold my hand out and shake them and sort of say thank you very much.
Well, what have you taken away from this experience? Something small, perhaps. I mean, I'm sure that it's changed many things. But, you know, is there something different that you do on a daily basis that you wouldn't have if you hadn't taken this journey to find your family?
Well, I suppose other than finding them, the biggest move I've made is probably that I'm trying to learn Tigrinya. So I'm having weekly lessons. And it's a slow process. There are three of us in the class, but everybody else has got parents who they live with who speak Tigrinya to them on a regular basis. So I'm easily the worst in my class, but I think I'm probably making up for it in enthusiasm. And I have a huge incentive now, which is something that I wouldn't have had before.
Well, it was great talking to you, Hannah. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was journalist Hannah Poole, a feature writer at The Guardian newspaper. Her memoir is called My Father's Daughter, A Story of Family and Belonging. She joins us from the studios at BBC Bush House. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Can anyone become a published author? Now more and more aspiring writers are putting pen to paper or typing on their laptops. But just how easy is it for African Americans to get that sweet deal with a major publishing house? Are some simply looking to the world of self-publishing? To discuss this and the future of black publishing overall, we've got Haki Madhubuti, founder of Third World Press, one of the oldest independent black publishers in the U.S. We also have author Quincy Troop. His many works include Miles and Me and The Pursuit of Happiness, and Nakia Murray, founder of The Literary Consultant Group, an organization that advises authors on the process of self-publishing. Hi, guys.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
How you doing, Farai?
I'm doing great. It's such an honor to have you guys with me, and all of you are people who are helping to reshape literature on a daily basis. So let me start with you, Haki. The Third World Press was something that you started over 40 years ago. Why and how?
Well, Quincy Troop and I come out of the same tradition. We felt that if you are writing about your own traditions, and any people who are in control of their own cultural imperatives are writing about their traditions, that we looked around the world, the country, and we saw that other men and women in their particular tradition were starting publishing companies. And so with $400 and the mimeograph machine, I started Third World Press in 1967 after working with Dudley Randall, who had started Broadside Press in Detroit, Michigan in 1966. So being a part of a very difficult and awesome struggle, the civil rights struggle, the black empowerment struggle, the black arts movement, we all came out of that movement talking about building independent black institutions. And I just took it a little bit further and dedicated my life. I'm primarily a poet. Yeah, so I come out of this tradition in writing poetry, and which I still am, but the business side, so we not only have Third World Press, we also operate four schools here in Chicago, too. So this question of building independent black institutions, it becomes the underside of a strong people. You look, when you look at a people, you look at their institutional structures. And so for us, publishing, especially creative works, was something that was drastically missing in the black community.
Most things that succeed are at the precipice of failure many different times. So what was one moment where you had to make a choice that this was going to succeed despite what other people told you, whether it was a financial moment, a moment in your own personal life? What, for example, was a challenge that you faced and you got through?
Well, I guess one of the major challenges have always been dealing with the federal government, most certainly in terms of taxes. Not being a trained business person, much of what I did in the early days was, you know, learning on the job. And so we were hit with a major, major tax bill once that almost put us out of business. But essentially, you know, I had to borrow money to deal with that. And then I think the other large question, we own our own headquarters here in Chicago. About 20 years ago, we bought a half a block here in Chicago. And out of the black publishers in the United States, there are only two black publishers that own their own headquarters. That's Johnson Publishing Company here in Chicago and Third World Press here in Chicago. And so buying this property moved us to another whole level in terms of dealing with the underpinnings of how do you run a successful business. And so therefore I've had on a job training all the way through the 42 years that we've been alive. And then working full-time at Chicago State University, I direct the MFA program in creative writing at Chicago State. So I've never taken a salary out of Third World Press or our schools. So I've had to work these jobs as well as write.
Yeah.
So it's always been a 14, 15-hour day, including Sundays. And it has not gotten any easier, especially now with the economic downturn as it is today.
Wow. That's dedication right there. Quincy, you too have been a part of trying to create not just a literary body of work yourself, but to really help nurture other authors as well, you and your wife. Given that you have published 18 books to date with major publishing houses, what is your space in the literary world on a business end? Do you think that you do best by working with mainly with one publisher? Do you float from publishing house to publishing house? For you, doing what you do, what works when you need to get your work published?
I kind of the first book I published was a book called Watts Poets and Writers, which I published, I self-published in Los Angeles when I was living there, which we published poets and writers like Jane Cortez and Stanley Crouch and a whole bunch of other writers. I got together that money and I published that and proofread it and everything else. And then after that venture, I've published my work with small houses, small publishing houses, and major publishing houses. And so, to get right to the crux of what you just asked, I've kind of floated around on especially on the prose nonfiction side of things. For the most part, I published my poetry with small presses. I started out with a black publisher in New York, a little small black publisher in New York, and he died. And then I moved over to Coffee House Press in Minneapolis, which has published all of my poetry since that time. But the Miles books I published with major houses, The Pursuit of Happiness I published with major houses, the James Baldwin book I published with major houses, and then the children's books that I write, I have published with major houses. I want to add another thing to that. I really have always respected Haki for what he's done and his perseverance and publishing all these writers. And we are both poets. He's a poet. I'm a poet. And we've come up the hard way through this whole environment. He also is a college professor. I was a college professor for 34 years, but I retired retired in 2003. And moved back to New York. But one of the other things that I would just want to mention, and I'll shut up, is that I've always been interested in, because he does the publishing, Haki does, and that, I think that's great. But I think we need journals and magazines. So I've always been in the business of starting magazines, Code Magazine, which came out of Los Angeles, and a number of other magazines, American Rag. I could just go down the list of a whole bunch of magazines that I've started. And now I'm editing a journal that comes out of New York University called Black Renaissance Noir, which I'm going to change the name in the next, not in this coming out issue, which will be out in about a month, but in the next one, it's going to be called Baobab. And so we're going to change the name to that. And that journal publishes fiction, nonfiction, poetry, essays, photographic essays, reproductions of artwork from African Americans, Africans, primarily Africans and African Americans, and Latino writers and Asian writers, and with some sprinkling of white writers in there.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with Black Renaissance, and so I look forward to Baobab. Nakia, let me turn to you. You are someone who's kind of the utility player of the book world. You can write, edit, publish. Tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Pretty much what we do at the Literary Consultant Group is we allow for authors that are looking to do their own thing or self-publish, as one may call it, to get all of their ducks in a row before kind of going out into the world blind, not really knowing, and making a lot of the mistakes that independent publishers or self-published authors make without having a certain amount of information. Along with publishing consultation, we also do provide marketing and publicity services as well to independent authors as well as small presses.
So when you think about the, you know, give me an example of what someone would have when they walked into you asking to be a client, and what advice you might give them once you had taken a look at their work.
Well, we get people at different stages, which is very interesting. We have some authors that come to us pretty much with just a manuscript. Then we have other people that will come to us after they have completed some of the steps, meaning they may already have a cover design, they may already have a title picked out, they may already have even printed some books already. And depending on really what it is that they need and what I see from my expertise as far as what they may need to change and start the process over again, those are the things that we help them out with. Some people, you know, may have cover treatments that are just not going to work in the marketplace, and we will coach them and advise them of new and innovative cover treatments that may help increase awareness and bring people to their project. some folks don't understand that exterior layout is just as important as interior layout. So proper typesetting as well as professional editing is key in putting out your own work.
Sorry, I want to jump in so that each of you has a chance to weigh in on this. Just quickly, maybe each of you could give me a sense of what you think the best play is for people who are trying to get books published. Meaning, should you go ahead and self-publish? Should you approach an existing small publisher? Should you try to, you know, pitch to the majors? Haki, what do you think?
Well, let me just give you a little bit of background on what's happening today. There are about six or seven black publishers that are active. And we've all cut back because of the economy, but other than Johnson Publishing Company, Broadside Press, there's also Black Classic Press. There's Just Us Books that are basically children's books. You have African World and Red Sea Press. You have Amber Books, and of course, Third World Press. You have to understand that the whole publishing industry is controlled by probably seven international conglomerates. And four of those are foreign-owned. And out of the big seven, most of them are in Munich, London, and Sydney, but all have offices in the New York mm-hmm. area. And 80% of the books that are published come from those seven conglomerates. And there exist in the country now about 85,000 small and self-publishers and in the country. And so self-publishing is not something that is off the table. We suggest, because we publish somewhere between 20 and 25 books a year, and that's a lot for us in terms of the resources that are available. And so we do suggest, I mean, my first book, I self-published my first book, Think Black, back in 1966. And so it's not off the table. I think that with the guests that you have today, what is clear is that many of these young people need to study publishing. One, two,
yes.
need to study layout, design,
uh-huh.
and so forth. All that's absolutely necessary.
So, Nakia, from your perspective, what's the best play for someone who wants to go ahead and publish? I mean, you have a very specific way of coaching people through and doing it in a business context. Who do you tell, look, don't even try it?
You know, what's interesting is that the people that do not have a business mind, folks that may not have the greatest personality, or those that are not really open to new ideas, those are people that I may say, OK, I don't believe that you're ready. I'm looking for individuals that at least at minimal have done some type of research. A lot of people contact me via the Internet. So if you have taken the time to research companies like mine and have come across me, you have maybe bypassed a lot of information that you could have kind of absorbed before even coming to a company like mine. If a person just wants to, let's say, hustle books and not really understand the business, I'm not really interested in taking on clientele like that, because I do take publishing pretty seriously. And you can be very successful, but you can also cause yourself a lot of heartache and ultimately, you know, your demise if things are not handled properly.
Yeah, we've seen certainly a bunch of lawsuits over some of the, you know, books where people, it's like it was so-and-so, the ghostwriter for so-and-so, and it doesn't appear that legal contracts were drawn up, and then you get mm-hmm. everything all tied up in lawsuits. Quincy, what have you learned that you would pass on to someone who was fledgling and who believed in their own work but who didn't come through any pipeline, like through a literary, you know, MFA program where at least you get contact, somebody who was coming cold just because they believed in their own writing?
I've had a lot of my students who came out of workshops that I ran, or students of mine who did not get to the level where where people would publish their work, and I advised them to self-publish it if they wanted to. But then I also told them that that's a very difficult thing to self-publish, because not only do you have to put out the money to do it, you have to know how to market the book. You have to know how to market. You have to copy edit. You have to lay out the whole the layout and design that was talked about earlier. You have to do that, and then you have to go out and drum up readings for yourself. So it's a very difficult thing to self-publish. It's not so easy, because you get 2,000 books, and then what do you do with the 2,000 books? Nobody knows who you are, and you can't mm-hmm. get on any radio shows. You can maybe go to your church and pass them out, or sell them in the church. But you have to really think that through seriously if you're going to self-publish. But I think that it's an alternative. I think that Haki's Press, if somebody is good, I would recommend them. I would recommend that writer to go to Haki and send the manuscript there, or to any other African American press, or a small press. And I've recommended people to other people, and they've been published. So that's what I would do myself, because I've been in this a long time, and I have a track record, and I have books that sell a lot, copies. And so people come to me, the major houses come to me. I don't go to them. I don't go looking for them. They come to me and ask me about, would you like to do this? But for people who don't have that advantage, then I would say to them that they should look at it hard and long, and then make up their mind. You know, some people think that if they publish a book and they have never done anything, that it's just going to sell. You know, it's not right. It's not like that.
And that's a big misconception.
Guys, I have to unfortunately stop us here, but I think that this is a perfect opportunity for us to continue this online. So I'm going to see, I will contact you. I won't make you commit to this now, but I'm going to see if you'd be willing to answer a few questions, because I know people will have them. So we'll be in touch with you about that, because people want the information. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you.
We were hearing from Haki Madhubuti, founder of Third World Press, one of the oldest independent black publishers in the U.S., also with author Quincy Troop. His many works include Miles and Me and The Pursuit of Happiness. He joined us from NPR's New York studios. And Nakia Murray, the founder of the Literary Consultant Group, an organization that advises writers on the process of self-publishing. We spoke to her from Audio House Studios in Philadelphia. And that's our show for today. You can visit us online at nprnewsandnotes.org. NPR's News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, Senate officials give their stamp of approval to former Illinois Attorney General Roland Burris. That and more in politics.